Okay, so this week we come to the end of Chumash VaYikra with the parshas of Bahar and Mechukosai. And the parsha of Bahar, of course, begins with matters of Shemitah and Yovel. And we always start there, and we don't always get beyond there. And I'd like to actually start at a bit of a later stage in Parshas Bahar. In Mirtz Hashem, we will have time at the end to come back to discuss one or two matters Shemitah related. But the point that I'd like to start is actually just a few psukim after Shemitah. Almost all of Parshas Bahar is Perek Kaf Hei. And let us begin with Perek Kaf Hei, Pasuk Yud Dalet. So it's Sheni, and Rishon has given us Shemitah, also Yovel. In a few Psukim time, we'll come back to Shemitah questions, actually, in Psukim Yotes and Kaf. But in the interim, we have the area of Torah known as Ona'ah, which is, well, let us see how the Pasuk describes it, and then we'll see what we say. V'chitim keru mimkar la'mitecha. If you sell something to your fellow, o kanomia demitecha, or you purchase from your fellow, altonu ish es achiv. Do not literally oppress each other. But what does it mean to oppress each other? In what way? How does that relate to a sale or a purchase? Rashi explains, zo onas mamon. This refers to monetary oppression. And specifically, it refers to either significantly overcharging or underpaying. And this now becomes the whole issue of ona'ah, and you have to know how to determine the price of any given commodity, and how much more than that would void the sale, how much do you just need to return the difference. And these are the sugyas that occupied the Gemara in the fourth perek of Maseches Bava Metzia. So that's onas mamon. Whoever sells should not charge too much for it. Whoever purchases shouldn't pay too little for it. They should find the right price, and everyone should profit and be happy. That is lotonu, as found in Pasuk Yud Dalet. But the word lotonu will come back again in three psukim time, Pasuk Yud Zayin, V'losonu ish es amiso, you shall not, once again, ona'ah, oppress one, his fellow, V'yareisem elokecha, should fear your God, ki ani Hashem elokechem. So if Pasuk Yud Dalet, which said lotonu, altonu ish es achiv, refers to purchases and money, what then is the losonu in Pasuk Yud Zayin? So here Rashi says, kan his here al ona'as devarim. Here we're no longer talking about financial oppression in the form of overcharging or underpaying. Rather, we're talking about ona'as devarim, verbal oppression. And we have to find out what that means. What is ona'as devarim? Verbal oppression. Why do we say this? After all, the words are identical. Altonu, altonu, in Pasuk Yud Dalet and Pasuk Yud Zayin. Why do we assume that they mean different things? Well, the answer, very simply, is because the Pasuk has been repeated. In other words, we've already heard in Pasuk Yud Dalet, altonu, do not oppress. And within the context of sales, obviously, we would assume that's referring to monetary oppression, overcharging and underpaying. But when Pasuk Yud Zayin says it again, the repetition itself forces us to conclude that we're talking about a different type of ona'ah. And thus, we arrive at the understanding of ona'as devarim. This is the background to Rashi's shift in explanation. It's not repeated. It's reiterated, but this is a different version of ona'ah, verbal ona'ah. And this is explicit in the Gemara, which is the source for Rashi, it literally states this. I may have thought that the second time round is financial oppression, but it's been said already. So therefore, we conclude that it's ona'as devarim. And these are the two types of ona'a. Interestingly, the codifiers of the mitzvahs, Rambam, Sefer HaChinuch, actually list ona'as mamon, which is the focus of Pasuk Yud Aled, and ona'as devarim, which is Pasuk Yud Zayin, as two separate los ases in the Torah. For Rambam, it's los ase number 250 and 251. And for Sefer HaChinuch, it's number 337 and 338. So that, I think, also shows us that the second pasuk, it's not merely another variation or another element within Onah. It is literally its own mitzvahs, los ase of the Taryag mitzvahs. But what is Ona'as Devarim? And I think the chiddush, that there is such a concept called Ona'as Devarim, verbal oppression, is that I think we might have been inclined, we have to define it, but we may have been inclined to see verbal oppression as more in the realm of not menschlichtige conduct, or that's not the way, it's not proper, one should, a Baal Midos doesn't speak in that way, which of course is all true. I don't know that we would have seen within this a Torah prohibition. We're more familiar with Lashon Hara, of course, to speak about someone behind their back, and maybe even publicly humiliating someone, which also we're very aware of. Malbin Pnei Chaver Barabim, these are very, very severe. But Ona'as Devarim can just be you talking to the other person and no one else sees, and it's they feel bad, and of course it's not correct. But our Pasuk and the Rambam and the Sefer HaChinuch and others alert us to the fact that it's more than improper. It's a low sase. So what is included? So interestingly, as is often the case, the Gemara doesn't define the parameters. It illustrates them. It gives examples. And from those examples, one should be able to fathom the sense of what we're talking about. And it brings four examples. They're quite different from each other. And it's amazing how they all come together, because of course they all revolve around the central concept of verbal oppression. The first example, says the Gemara, it's in the Gemara in Bamitzia and Daf Nun Ches. It's also in the Teras Kohanim, some of the examples, Teras Kohanim to our Pasuk. If he was a Baal Tshuva, says the Gemara, don't remind him of his earlier times. Al tomar lo zechor ma'asecha harishonim. Why? Because you make him feel bad. So that's example number one. And I think what's quite interesting about this example is that in order to understand how this is such a terrible thing to say, we need to appreciate that the term Baal Tshuva in the Gemara is quite different than the term Baal Tshuva as we use it. In the sense that when we talk about a Baal Tshuva, we don't talk about someone who knowingly did the wrong thing and then did Tshuva. I mean, as far as we're concerned, that's hopefully the entire Jewish people, at least the second part. That's how things are. But of course, as we know, in our parlance, the reference to a Baal Tshuva is someone whose earlier stage in life or earlier years, they weren't familiar yet with Torah, or they didn't know. And it's quite different than the Baal Tshuva as Chazal talk about it. When Chazal talk about a Baal Tshuva, they're not talking about someone who grew up in a secular environment and didn't know. No one grew up in a secular environment in those times. Everyone knew, which means if a person did the wrong thing, it's they're at fault. And therefore, it's embarrassing to remind them of the fact that they knowingly strayed, even though good for them that they came back. That stigma exists because of the nature of what they're doing tshuva for. But I wonder whether the same thing is true in our times, where the people that we call Baal Tshuva, they never strayed in that way. It could be that their parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents did, and here they are just finding their way back. In fact, in many cases, not only are they not embarrassed to be reminded of their past, they will talk about it openly, and perhaps you would talk about it on the radio. And as many people as possible should know about it. And in many cases, rightly so, because there is no fault to attach to them. It's only to their credit that they came from lack of knowledge, how they came and drew closer. So it's very interesting to see how this would be translated into our experience. To say that it's onas devarim, to remind the Baal Tshuva of their past, is likely someone who was always from, who then significantly went off and then came back. That's the type of person we're talking about. But the classic Baal Tshuvas of our times, there's books written about their past, and they're published and disseminated, and people pay money for them. And with the full consent of the, it's considered to be a good thing. So that's interesting to ponder and consider in that regard. So that's example number one. Don't remind the Baal Tshuva of his past. Example number two, if a person is suffering, says the Gemara, don't talk to them the way Eov's friends spoke to him. Because when they came to him, at least some of them, they basically said, you know, if you're suffering like this, there must be a reason, meaning you're presumably you are at fault. And your wrongdoings brought this upon you. It's interesting that Eov's friends were considered to be very good friends. The Gemara does say that if a person doesn't have friends like Eov, o chavraya, o misusa, either friends or death. In other words, one should have friends like Eov's. They meant it well. And in fact, I heard from my father's atzal many years ago, how do we know that better not to be alive than to be alive without friends? How do we know that? So he said, because the Gemara the Pasuk says, but it's elaborated by the Gemara in Maseches Bavar Basra towards the end of the first perek, that Hashem told the Satan, go and take everything that from Eov, but just be sure to leave him alive. Take everything that you can, but nothing that will kill him. And Satan took everything from him, obviously with Hashem's sanction, but not his friends. They're still there. From which we learn that had he taken his friends, that would have been the end for Eov. You can't take his friends and him still considered being left alive. As the Gemara says, O chavraya, O misusa. So on the one hand, they are considered to be good friends, but their response to Eov's suffering is not considered to be correct, because they came and they said, you should search your ways. Presumably this is your fault. And we're here to remind you to do some soul searching. Says the Gemara, that's onas devarim. That's very interesting that it's onas devarim. It's also verbal oppression. You make the person feel bad. He's suffering enough as it is. He doesn't need to hear from you that it's probably his fault. Even though, what's interesting is, there is a possibility that it is his fault. In fact, the Gemara says, in Maseches Brachos and Daf Hei, that if a person undergoes suffering, chas v'shalom, difficulties and tribulations, yifash beish b'ma'asav. He should inspect his deeds. Why should he inspect his deeds? Because he should assume that there's something that he needs to correct, and he's receiving a message. So this is very interesting, because it's another example of the kind of dichotomy that exists between what it's a person's own business to conclude for themselves and what it's not your business to tell them. In other words, here, in cosmic terms, it could be that it's true. Maybe there is a wrongdoing, but that's for him. That's for him to, that's the Gemara is for him, not for you. Very often, there are certain situations that call for a bit of soul searching. It's very important for a person to realize whose soul they're meant to be searching in in these situations. Generally, it's their own and not someone else's. And so we have the situation whereby the correct, from his point of view, it is correct for him to examine his deeds, but it's not correct to tell him about it. That's an interesting balance that needs to be struck. And that is the second example of onas devarim. If a person is suffering, you should offer them empathy, you should offer them support, you should offer them encouragement. You don't need to offer them your wisdom in terms of what they possibly could have done wrong in order to bring this about, unless they ask you. A third example, again, they're so interesting because each one is its own niche in terms of what would make a person feel bad. But the Gemara says that you should not inquire as to the price of a product if you're not intending to buy it. And the reason why is because the seller, when you start inquiring, certainly to, let's say, a significant degree, they assume you're inquiring with intent to purchase. You show an interest, and all the while you have no interest at all in purchasing this. You're just waiting for a friend, or you're just waiting for the bus, or something, and you have a few moments, and you don't wish to stand idly there, and therefore you engage them in conversation in a way that gives them to understand that you're actually interested, and then you just drop the whole thing and leave. And once again, the feeling that they will get, where there was a certain expectation which was falsely led on, and then the disappointment that comes out, that's onas devarim. Very interesting. And here too, there's room to ponder the parameters. I'm sure the poskim talk about all these things, but one wonders, perhaps sometimes it might make them feel better to take an interest in their merchandise. Sometimes if you have someone and literally people are walking by and not noticing them at all. So I wonder whether there's room to say, without giving them to feel that you're actually about to make a purchase, and then say, well, I'm actually not interested. But at least to notice them and to say, how much is this? And they say, someone has finally seen them and asked them a question. There's hope. It might not be you, but at least you've revived their spirits because no one else spoke to them since the beginning of the day. And if you leave them with a few words, it looks very good. I don't have money at the moment, but it's very good quality. I hope that people pick up on it and so on and so forth. So perhaps there's, in some respects, a way of actually helping them by taking some level of interest. Let them know that they've been seen, and they're not just to be completely ignored. And I wonder whether there's a variation on this theme also, which is, it could be that you have no intention of buying anything. But if you take an interest, it could be that other people will take an interest also. Mitzvah gereres mitzvah, as if to say, no one's really noticing them, but you do when you start, and then someone else notices, and they... So in the interest of generating interest, these are all interesting questions as to whether this would still be onas devarim, because you yourself are not planning on making the purchase. But we're all familiar with someone who literally drives the store owner mishuga for every single possibility, and they never had any intention of buying anything in the first place. This was just their idea of a good afternoon out. The fourth example, also mentioned, again different, says the Gemara, if people come to you and they say, where can we buy wheat? And you send them to so-and-so. And you know that so-and-so doesn't sell wheat. To do that is onas devarim. Now, why is that onas devarim? Effectively, they'll come to him and they'll say, we heard you sell wheat, and no, he doesn't. And that's onas devarim. Where is onas devarim? It's a waste of time. Perhaps that's a problem, that they will feel disappointed that you just sent them there for nothing. It could be more than that. They'll feel foolish a little bit because there they were turning up to buy wheat. He doesn't buy wheat. It's such a misunderstanding. It's such an awkward and unpleasant and uncomfortable situation that you set up. And maybe you think it's funny. But for them, it's just they feel like a little awkward. And that's and many a joke would probably fit into that type of category where the result is that so-and-so feels like a bit foolish for having done something or said something. And that's the fourth example. So this whole world of onas devarim, it covers a large swath of human interaction in one form or another. And it's amazing to see how sensitive the Torah itself in terms of this prohibition, this mitzvah, this negative mitzvah, demands the sensitivity that we have. So much so, the Gemara concludes and says that onas devarim, verbal oppression, is worse than financial oppression. We discovered verbal oppression 3 psukim later. For us, the obvious one is financial oppression, overcharging, underpaying, and all of that. And then the pasuk repeated, and we said, oh, there's this other thing called onas devarim. But the Gemara says onas devarim is worse, and the reason why is very simple. If someone overcharged you, you can get your money back. And generally speaking, when a person was overcharged and they get their money back, it's pretty much the end of it. But if someone upset you or insulted you or offended you or made you despondent, or those things don't go away so easily. And they're not money that can be returned, and then you're back to where you started. In terms of the results, therefore, the Gemara says, in many respects, onas devarim can be greater than onas mamon. And how? And the pasuk hasn't finished with us yet in the world of onas devarim, because it goes on. It concludes by saying again, pasuk yud zayin, velo sonu ish es amiso v'yoreisa me'elokecha, and you should fear your God. What does that mean? You should fear your God. Rashi, in other contexts, says, and actually here also that we didn't. Rashi is its own limud that we need to a separate session for which aspects he cites, and he actually adds one another one. But v'yoreisa me'elokecha means if it's never fully clear that you're doing something wrong, and you could very easily excuse yourself as being completely benign, but you aren't, that's when we say v'yoreisa me'elokecha. When the Torah tells you not to ignore something, it's ad v'yoreisa me'elokecha. Because who can know if you're ignoring it? You could say, I didn't see it. But if you did, so Hashem knows. V'yoreisa me'elokecha. What does that have to do with onas devarim? Sometimes you can make a comment and on the face of it, it's an innocent comment, but the person you're talking to knows exactly what you mean, exactly how you meant it, and they get upset, and that's part of the isser, and you might say, what I said was completely innocent. I just referred to something. I didn't mean anything bad by it. But if you did, v'yoreisa me'elokecha. In other words, you might be able to fool the listeners to feel that he took offense needlessly. But if you really did intend it, and he knows that you did, so that's v'yoreisa me'elokecha. Sometimes a person can take offense needlessly. Sometimes offense is taken where none was given. Sometimes the entire offense is the production of the receiver. And you're not quite sure what happened. All you said was something that you really did not mean badly. It can happen. But it can also happen that you did intend it. About that, we say, v'yoreisa me'elokecha. So these are some, again, the description is a collage that comes out from the illustrations, these four different types of onas devarim. And what is the moral of the story? What is the upshot of all of this? It's summed up by the Sefer HaChinuch in Mitzvah Shin Lamed Ches 338. Shorish Mitzvah Zo. We know the Sefer HaChinuch will always provide what he calls a Shorish Mitzvah, the root of the mitzvah, a way of understanding what the mitzvah is about. Yadua, it's well known. Kihulatet shalom bein abrios. It's to promote peace between people. They shouldn't be talking to each other in that way. The gadol shalom, how great is peace? Shabo habracha metzuya be'olam. There's peace, blessing is found in the world. The kosha machlokas, How terrible is dispute? Kama klolos v'kama takolos teluyuzba. How many curses and how many calamities are attendant to machlokas? So says the Sefer HaChinuch, if you want to sum it all up in three lines, that's where you have it. And of course, the chiddush is not that that's what the mitzvah is all about. But it's certainly very worthwhile to consult and to ponder these examples and what they tell us about onas devar. So from Psukim Yudalit and Yud Zayin, let us keep moving within Parshas Bahar, and we'll get to Pasuk Lamed Hey. Well, Lamed Hey and Lamed Vav, we'll read the Psukim, we'll get the context, and then we'll get to the section that, or the discussion that we wish to to develop. So, V'chiyamuch achicha, U'matay ado imach. If your fellow becomes impoverished, and he begins to falter, help him, strengthen him. The Alshich points out something very interesting. Many of the psukim in our parsha are in the plural, but many are in the singular, and it shifts. And generally, in a situation where someone needs something and anyone could help them, the pasuk addresses itself in the singular, addresses Jewish people in the singular. And what he means to say is, there are many laws which obviously apply to everyone. And therefore the Torah refers to it in the plural and everyone understands that the Torah is talking to them. But if someone needs something, it's very easy for everyone to think that the Torah is talking to the other person. It's not my problem. Someone needs to do something. But who's to say that I'm that someone? And for those mitzvahs, the Torah shifts to the singular, as if to say, each and every person, there's only one person the Torah is talking to, that person is you, if there's something that you can do about it. So a very interesting comment of the Alshich and Pasuk, Lamed Hei says, help him out, v'cheimach, let him live with you. That meaning he should live, sustain him with you. Al tikach me'ito neshech v'tarvis. We have a reiteration of the prohibition against lending with usury, with interest. It's been mentioned already in Parshas Mishpatim. Comes back again here. V'yareisim elokecha, once again, v'yareisim elokecha. Don't try anything and devious and say I didn't mean it, or however. V'chei achicha imach, your brother shall live with you. Now, there's much to say about every element of the psukim that we've, or each and every one, but I'd like to focus on a very well-known discussion that revolves around the final three words, which are v'chei achicha imach. And the background is well-known. It's a case which is in the Gemara in Bar Metzia, Daf Samach Beis, and it says as follows. Presents us a scenario. Shnayim shahayu mahalchim baderech. If you have two people, they're walking along the way. In other words, but they're out of the way. They're away from civilization. Uviyat echad mehen kiton shamayim. One of them has a flask of water. Now, the situation is as follows. Im shosim shnehem. Mesim, there's not enough for both of them. So, which means if they divide it, and each one drinks half, neither of them will make it. It's not enough. Vim shevse echad mehem, if one of them will drink it, magil yishuv. So the assessment is that he'll be able to make it to back to civilization and continue. The other one, unfortunately, won't. So now the question is, what should he do? Should they divide it? Shouldn't they divide it? Should one take it? And here, there was something of a machlokas. Darish ben Petura. Ben Petura, who's quoted not very often, I think maybe just even only once a handful of times. Mutav shiyish tu shnehem v'yamusu. Better they should both drink and both die. V'al yira echad mehem b'misoso shel chavira. Let not one drink and see the other one die. So this is Ben Petura's assessment of the situation. However, he was disputed at Shabbat, Rabbi Akiva, the limit, until Rabbi Akiva came and he taught V'chei Achicha Imach. V'chei Achicha Imach, which is actually a quotation taken from our pasuk. So obviously we lift it in a sense out of context, but we see the principle. V'chei Achicha Imach teaches us Chayecha Kodmin L'Chayecha Vecha. Your life comes first. Your life takes precedence. So obviously it's a very difficult situation, but by definition it's been constructed in that way. But as far as the Rebbe Akiva is concerned, V'chei Achicha Imach teaches that whoever has the flask, if they need to drink the whole thing in order to get to where they need to get to, then that's what they need to do. The alternative, certainly, to split it and neither of them will make it, that's not an option as far as Rabbi Akiva is concerned. And that whoever has the flask, they can drink the water. Now, needless to say, there's many important questions that one can raise and should raise with regards to this scenario as described, in order to see just how much we can learn from this for other situations. Because some things are not fully explicated, and others are perhaps not fully clarified. We begin with Ben Petura. Ben Petura says, better they should both drink, let one not see. Of the two opinions, Rabbi Akiva cited a source. His source is V'chei Achicha Imach. From that he learns, Chayecha Kodmin. Ben Petura didn't cite any source. He just says, it's better. It's better they should both drink, even if they'll both die, that one not see the death of the other. And the question is, where does that come from? He doesn't cite a source. And is it always true? Is it always true that they should both die, let one not see the death of the other? Roshe Weiss raises the question, what if a person came and said, a bandit, a murderer came and was going to kill one of them. The other one needs to let himself be killed as well so that he shouldn't see the death of his fellow. Things don't normally work that way according to anyone. So what exactly is behind Ben Petura's position? It's not so clear. Secondly, when we say that if they both drink, they'll both die, do we know that for sure? As if to say, they are in the middle of nowhere. But these things are very, very difficult to quantify. In other words, each one has half the amount. You never know. Someone might come by traveling. They're traveling. Someone else might be traveling that could save them. It could be that it will only keep both of them going for an hour. That's not a lot. But who knows what will happen in that hour? So when we say that if they both drink, they'll both die, how certain can we be of that? And by the same token, when we say that if one of them drinks, he will live. Well, how certain can we be of that? In other words, how do we know? How far is he away? It's a very, very specific situation to know for a fact that if he drinks the whole thing, he'll definitely be okay. Maybe he won't. Maybe it'll take him longer than he thought. So all of these variables, in a sense, are difficult to lock down. And obviously, each one makes a big difference, because are we talking about a case where they will definitely both die if they both drink? Will he definitely make it if he does? There's many, many gray areas in between. And also of interest, and we're raising these points actually on the way to talk about another aspect, but we will need to come back and discuss this more fully for itself. But again, in the situation as presented, one of them has the flask of water. One of them has the bottle of water. And therefore, for Rabbi Akiva, when we say Chayecha Kodmim, then we allow him to keep it. But that's assuming that of the two people there who both need water, one of them owns the water and the other one doesn't. What if they are co-owners of the water, but one of them's holding it? What if no one owns any water and they both come across a bottle of water? Or what if there's three people there and he has enough for himself and for one other person? So to all of these situations, and each of them would be a precedent for many other situations which unfortunately have happened over the ages, where people needed to make decisions like this. And therefore, all of these elements of the scenario need to be weighed up in order to see what the message would be. But having raised all of those questions, let us come back to what Rabbi Akiva said in the first place, and that is, he learns from the words "Vechei achicha imach, chayecha kodmin." And the moral of the story is, and what does it mean? It means he should live, but he should live with you. So if you're not there, so then he can't live with you if you're not there, because if you're dead, so then that's not Vechei achicha imach. And it means he's with you, but you come first. And that's acceptable. And this, of course, is the famous Rabbi Akiva who says, "V'haftarecha kamocha, zeh klal gadol b'Torah." Yes, but chayecha kodmin. The shaila is, and the famous question that is raised, in the world of Eved Ivri, we know, it's a well-known set of halachas, that the halacha requires that the master take care of the eved, of the servant, in basic things, as much as he takes care of himself. And so much so, that if there are certain basic things, and there's only one of them, it should go to the servant, and not the master. The Yerushalmi famously says, if a person buys a servant for himself, he's bought a master for himself, the amount you need to take care of him. But where does this come from? Where does this requirement that if there's only one thing, you need to give it to him, you can't keep it for yourself? It comes from the words, "Ki tov lo imach." This is in Parshas Re'eh. Eved Ivri is mentioned three times in the Torah. Of course, in the beginning of Mishpatim, it opens Parshas Mishpatim. It's actually mentioned in our Parsha as well, Parshas Behar, towards the end, and in Parshas Re'eh for a third time. And there it says, "Ki tov lo imach," it's good for him with you, says the Gemara. Imach means he's like you, no less. And if there's only one thing, it's got to go to him. The Gemara said, if there's only one pillow, he gets it, not the master. Ki tov lo imach, he's got to be like you. He can't be less than you. So both of these halachas, I think, are well known, but it might not have occurred to us to contrast them with each other, because they are both seemingly coming from the same word, imach, and they give opposite messages. In our parsha, where it says, "V'chei achicha imach," imach says, he's with you, but you come first. Chayecha kodmin. That's what imach teaches us in our parsha. But with Eved Ivri, when it says, "Ki tov lo imach," we say, he's like you, and he comes first. And he can't be less than you. We don't. Whatever happened to Chayecha Kodmin? Interesting shaila. And there's many answers to this question. But I'd like to share with you a most unusual answer that came out as a result of an episode that took place during the Second World War. Time was when you could just say during the war, but you can't say that anymore. You have to specify which one. But during the Second World War, so there were a group of refugees, children, and they came from Eastern Europe. They took a very circuitous route. They actually came through Iran, and they were known as Yaldei Tehran. They weren't from Iran, but they came through Iran, and they came to Eretz Yisrael. And the activists in the Frum communities were looking to get as many as they could for them. These were people from Frum homes. These were children from Frum homes, and they wanted to give them a Frum upbringing, whatever. And many of them were brought to Bnei Brak, where the Panovich Rav, the famous Rav Kahneman, lived. So here, a large group of these children arrived, but they arrived with nothing. And the people in town didn't really have that much to give. But something had to be done, because they literally they had just the clothes on their back, and they had no blankets, no anything really. So the Panovich Rav let it be known that he was to give a drasha in the main shul that evening. So of course the Panovich Rav's drashas were legion, and everyone turned up to hear what the Panavijarov was going to say. And he began by raising this question that we asked. Namely, once again, when we say v'chayachicha imach, your brother should live with you. So from that we learn that you come first. Apparently the word imach means with you, but you come first. But with regards to an Eved Ivri, so it says ki tov lo imach, and he seems to come first. And that's the contradiction, and that's how he began his drasha. And what's the resolution? Says the Panavicharav, the answer is that in both cases, you come first. Both of those places means you come first. We look out for you first. What does that mean? It means that in the wilderness case, Rabbi Akiva mit Petura, it's pretty clear. If you have the water, you can drink it. You don't need to give or to share it if that won't help anyone. And you're allowed to look out for yourself first, because b'chei achicha imach means your life takes precedence. That's what it means there. Says the Panavicharav, and that's exactly what it means with every case also. You come first. But what does it mean? What it means is that when the Gemara says that if there's only one pillow, you give it to the Eved Ivri, because kitov lo imach, the basis is because you come first. And that's why you have to give them the pillow. But why? Because, says the Panavicharav, if you don't give them the pillow and you use it, no one will sleep that night. This poor Eved won't sleep that night because he doesn't have a pillow. And neither will you, because how can you sleep when knowing that you're meant to be taking care of this Eved and there's one pillow and you took it for yourself? So in the interest of the master getting a good night's sleep, we say give it to the Eved, and then everyone will sleep well. The Eved will, because he has a pillow, and the master, because he'll sleep soundly knowing that he's taking care of his Eved. So it's exactly like we're concerned for the master. We want him to sleep at night. How can you sleep at night if there's one pillow and you took it for yourself? And that was the basis of his drasha. Because the Panavicharav says, I've called everyone here, the Frum Kehillah in Bnei Brak, to the shul in the interest of everyone getting a good night's sleep tonight. Because you have these children don't have anything, and I don't know how anyone's going to be able to sleep tonight if we don't do something. But if we do and help them sleep comfortably, then everyone else will be able to also. And that was Derech, that episode, and Derech, that drasha, that was his unique resolution of this famous question about the two imachs, the imach of v'chei achicha imach and the imach even Eved Ivri of kitov lo imach. Well, we started a little deep into the Parshas Behar, and then we went deeper still. But now I'd like to come back to the beginning of the Parsha to talk about matters of Shemitah. And what's noteworthy about the way Shemitah is presented is what will really give us a sense of what the goal of Shemitah is. After all, if we were asked to describe, what does Shemitah sound like? So we would say, presumably, that you work the land for 6 years, and the seventh year you need to give it a rest, give it a rest, give yourself a rest, for all the reasons. So the description begins by working for 6 years, and then resting on the seventh. But that's not how the Torah presents it. Because the parsha begins, "Vayidaber Hashem Moshe b'har Sinai le'emor, Shemitah etzel har Sinai, Pasuk beis, daber b'nei Yisrael v'matar lehem, ki sovo al ha'aretz, when you come to the land asher ani nosein lachem, v'shav sa ha'aretz, Shabbos l'Hashem, the land should rest." So the Torah's presentation of Shemitah actually starts with Shemitah. It starts with a description of the land resting, which of course chronologically won't happen until year 7. But it's mentioned first. Then in Pasuk Gimel, we get the Shemitah cycle. Sheishonim tizra sadecha, for 6 years you work the land, v'asavtas tevuasa, and then in Pasuk Dalet, u'bashana ha'shvi, is Shabbos Shabbos, in the seventh year, it's a rest. So, whereas we would have said, the description is, work for 6 years and rest on the seventh, the Torah says, when you come to the land should rest, work for 6 years, and then rest on the seventh. But why do we have an emanation from year seven, even before we've started year one? But this teaches us that the message of Shemitah is not just for the Shemitah year. The message of Shemitah is for all the years that follow. In a sense, by starting with Shemitah, it's saying that you can't have Shemitah, and you can't have the seventh year until you've had the first six. True. But when you have those six, they also are coming out of a Shemitah year. It's not like we don't think about Shemitah until towards the end of the sixth year, and then it's the seventh year, and you have to think about it, and then after Shemitah, you're just back to year one again, and don't think about it for another 7 years. On the contrary, the tone is set by Shemitah even for the 6 years, because whatever Shemitah is about is as important to remember during the 6 years that you're working the land as it is for the seventh year that you're not. Because what is the message of Shemitah? It's as the pasuk says later, Ki li ha'aretz, to remember the land belongs to Hashem. You emphasize that by not working on the seventh year, but it's true for the other 6 years as well. So it's not something that you want to forget. The message from the Shemitah year really should continue. It start the yearly cycle starts with Shemitah and ends with Shemitah, and the 6 years in between should be drawing from the Shemitah that preceded them, as well as leading up to Shemitah, because obviously you don't lay off the land for all 7 years. But the 6 years that you're working require that consciousness that the land is Hashem's, no less and possibly even more than during Shemitah itself. It's kind of unavoidable, that awareness during the Shemitah year. You much more need it during the 6 years that you're working the land. And that's why the Parsha begins, or describes the land again in Pasuk Beis, Ki Savo al Aretz Asher Ani Nasei Lachem. When you come to the land that I'm giving you, that retaining that awareness that the land of Israel is a land that's being given to the Jewish people by Hashem, and to remain connected with Him through the land, and not disconnected from Him because of the land, that's a decisive question. And that's what Shemitah is about. It brings to mind, once again, another discussion of someone who's traveling and he doesn't know where he is. Not only does he not know where he is, this is in the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos in Daf Samach Vav or Samach Zayin, and he's lost track of time. And so he doesn't know what day Shabbos is. So obviously, he can't just stay there permanently just in case every day is Shabbos, although it's possible, because then he'll never get anywhere. And if he doesn't know what day Shabbos is, then he just doesn't know. But the Gemara says, on a personal level, he needs his own Shabbos. He needs one day out of seven, until he gets back to civilization and finds out when Shabbos is, he needs to choose a day, which itself is an amazing idea. And then the question is, well, what day should he choose? I mean, he has no idea. And the answer is, it's a machlokas. There are two opinions in the Gemara as to which day he should choose. One opinion says he should, from the time he's lost track of time, just count 6 days. Those are his weekdays. And then the seventh day will be his Shabbos, where he rests up. And then the other opinion is, no, let him keep the first day as Shabbos and then travel for the other 6 days. It's an interesting machlokas. This person, he's away from civilization, doesn't know what day it is. All he knows is there's a machlokas as to which Shabbos he should keep. So that's company, at least it's Torah company. And whatever the halacha is, the halacha is. But the Shem Yishmuel, the Sochet Shava Rebbe, says that obviously halachically you need to decide. It's day one or day seven. But the fact that both of them are presented as possibilities teaches us that Shabbos is both day one and day seven, meaning it is the seventh day of the week in terms of the week that preceded it, but it's also the first day of the week in terms of the week that follows it. And the meaning is literally parallels what we're discussing in terms of Shemitah, as if to say, obviously you have the 6 days of the week, and then Shabbos, you rest. But whatever's meant to happen on Shabbos, the awareness of that Shabbos is meant to instill or restore to us in terms of our goals, ideals, our relationship with Hashem, with the world, and so on, all of those things, they're meant to stay with you. And in that respect, Shabbos is the first day of the week. The light of Shabbos is meant to beam forwards for another 6 days, not just to remain on the day of Shabbos itself. And that's very similar to what we're saying in terms of Shemitah. Shemitah begins with Shemitah and ends with Shemitah, because the light and illumination of the Shemitah year is as much relates to the 6 years that follow it, where it should be preserved, and not just the years that preceded it. And we can certainly understand, the more we ponder and reflect what's at stake in terms of what we could call Shemitah awareness, that it reminds us that the land is being given to us by Hashem, and we're on this side, he's on the other side. The land is in the middle. Again, the land is meant there to connect us, not to disconnect us. So we understand why the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, and it's really black and white in Parshas Bechukosai, that one of the consequences of not keeping Shemitah is exile. Because without keeping Shemitah and forfeiting the awareness of our presence and our relationship with Hashem vis-a-vis the land, then if you don't have that, so then you have a fragile basis to remain in the land. And thus, Shemitah is implicated as the cause of exile in our parasha, and also in Pirkei Avos, Golus Bala Olam, and one of the things is Shemitah. But by the same token, it's really another expression of this idea, the Medrash Tanchuma says that the mitzvah of Shemitah can bring the Geula. And on the one hand, the question is, well, do we have a mitzvah of Shemitah? The consensus is that Shemitah nowadays is Darabonah, not Minat Torah, for various reasons. But in terms of our discussion, it could be that as not only the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Shemitah can bring the Geula, but maintaining a consciousness of what Shemitah is there to tell us, that's what brings the Geula. The more we have an awareness, even in non-Shemitah years, of that message, so the more we're back on track to reconnect with Hashem through the land. There is a sefer called Teras Shavias. I had made a note of it, but I didn't note the author, and then I discovered that there's more than one person with a sefer called Teras Shavias. But I noted a number of years ago that he says it's chiddush, but I think we deserve one at this stage, that the Gemara says, if the Jewish people only kept two Shabbosos, il mali shomi soshte Shabbosos miyad nigali, they would be redeemed straight away. And of course, the question is, well, why two, and so on, and what's wrong with the first one, and what's incomplete about the first one? And there's many answers to that question, and we've mentioned, I think, even recently, the Ksav Kabbalah says that two Shabbosos means both elements of Shabbos, meaning both aspects of each Shabbos. Right, not only the Shabbos to rest, but also the Shabbos to settle and to restore and to regain our perspective. Even within one Saturday, there's two Shabbosos. But the Teras Shavias says that when it says, if the Jewish people kept two Shabbosos, they'd be redeemed, it refers to the two types of Shabbos. Shabbos of the week and Shabbos Haaretz, which is Shemitah. Because each one has its role in terms of getting the Jewish people, getting them on track, keeping them on track, maintaining consciousness. What Shabbos does with regards to the working week and the entire year, so too does Shemitah do with regards to the land of Israel. And I think what's so fascinating about this way of looking at it is that our own fulfillment of the mitzvah of Shemitah is perhaps sometimes sparse. If we ourselves are not farmers, it might determine what products we buy and so on. It's possible to navigate, I think it's fair to say, to navigate the year of Shemitah without it making too much of a difference. And from a certain point of view, then you kept it, but you missed it, because it has a message. As a message for everyone, not just the people on the farm, because whoever lives in the land of Israel, And moreover, the message is there not just for the mitzvah of Shemitah, not just for the year of Shemitah, but for all of those years. It should be a resounding message, a reverberating message. And it's a message that the more we hear those reverberations, the more we hear those echoes as they resonate throughout the other years, that the message is still there. Asher Anino, Sein Levnei Yisrael, consciousness of that, should Amit Hashem be setting us on the track as the second of the Shabbosos that should lead us to Geula, which is something we hope to meet and greet. Bekarov, B'meheir B'yameinu, Amin.